Welcome to Our Voices, Our Future, the podcast where we amplify the voices driving change, inequity within medicine and beyond. Brought to you by the Gender Equity Task Force, a committee of the American Medical Women's Association. We're here to challenge norms, break barriers, and ignite conversations that matter. I'm your host, Laura Oricochea, and in each episode, we'll bring you candid discussions with leaders, changemakers, and advocates working to create a more inclusive and just world. No more silence, no more waiting. It's time to get our voices, our future. Today, we're welcoming Janice Robinson Daly, author of The Unlocked Path and The Path Beneath Her Feet. A graduate of Wheaton College, Janice spent much of her career in sales and marketing before transitioning to full-time writing. Through her work in historical fiction, she brings to life the untold stories of women in early 20th century medicine. Her writing explores female-centric issues and the power of supportive relationships among women. Welcome, Janice. We're so happy to have you here with us today.
Oh, thank you, Laura. It's wonderful to reconnect with you folks and all the great work in so many different forms that AMWA puts together.
So to get us started, can you share how your journey as a writer began?
Certainly. So I took a very unusual path, if you will. I never set out to be a writer. I never set out to be an author. I did spend my career in sales and marketing, raised two sons with my family. But I was actually starting to think of a new hobby for myself after my kids got through college, and that was turning to genealogy research, and specifically into my grandmother Robinson's family, which came from Philadelphia. And it was through that discovery of looking into those roots that I found my great-great-grandfather, William Shannon Pierce, was quite an accomplished man of his times in Philadelphia. He was a lawyer involved in the abolitionist movement in Philadelphia in the 1850s and went on to become a judge in the Court of Common Pleas, the father to seven daughters and one son.
So
pretty much surrounded by women. And I'm learning all these amazing facts about him and reading even some essays and eulogies about him. And then the final line in an entry for his name in Famous Americans stopped me dead in my tracks. It read, "He was a founder of the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania." And I was just really blown away by the fact that there were women's medical schools. I had never heard of any of them before. And as a graduate of a women's college myself, Wheaton College in Massachusetts at the time I graduated was all women, since gone co-ed. But I was immediately drawn to this idea that there were women's medical schools because, you know, of course, in the 1800s, almost all medical schools denied women admission.
Right.
The Brown and the Harvards and Yales and Johns Hopkins and Penn of the world did not admit women. There were just a select few smaller schools, like, of course, the one in upstate New York that Elizabeth Blackwell went to. But the fact that there were forward-thinking men, including my great-great-grandfather, that founded this first women's medical school just really intrigued me. And I decided I wanted to just learn more about this medical school. And that gave me the idea of writing a book.
That is so cool that a search for a hobby led you to such an interesting discovery. So you could have written more specific to the time of the founding of the college in 1850 and your great-great-grandfather's role, maybe even have focused on the work of a forward-thinking man on behalf of women. What inspired you to focus more specifically on the lives of the students and graduates of the college?
At first I was thinking, wow, my ancestor, he needs to be honored for the work that he did. And I was even playing around with some ideas connected to his work in the abolitionist movement. And then I started researching women's medical further, and that's when I started to meet some other people along the road, and specifically the students, the staff, the dean, the professors, and the graduates, and what they went on to do. I mean, these were incredibly determined and then accomplished women of the 1800s. And then I started thinking more about them and why haven't I ever learned anything about them? Never heard of, you know, early women doctors. And I'm a huge fan of historical fiction. I'm an avid reader. I belong to multiple book clubs. We read a lot of historical fiction, and I had never read a book about women doctors, real women doctors. And this was in 2017 when this whole journey started. And so I thought, you know what? These women need to be celebrated. They need to be honored. And their stories, you know, like so many historical fiction novels of current recent times, have talked about, like, the women involved in, you know, World War II and the resistance in France and, you know, in the concentration camps and everything. But where was the story about these women in medicine? And so I decided I was going to pull them out of the shadows of history, and I was going to write their stories and celebrate them. So that's why I decided to focus more on the women of women's medical, and develop the story from there.
And honestly, I'm really glad you did, because as you said, we don't hear about those stories. That it's not very common, and I think it's so inspiring. Whenever I tell people that I'm in medical school, they're like, "Oh wow, good for you." But I think women of the past, they deserve so much more recognition for pushing those social expectations, because that was not the norm.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah.
And so I'm so glad that you chose to write about them instead. So for listeners who haven't read your books yet, can you share a brief overview of the plots of The Unlocked Path and its sequel, The Path Beneath Her Feet, without giving any spoilers?
Yes, I'll try. I try not to give away any spoilers. One thing you learn after you've written a book is the hardest thing is actually writing what's called a blurb. You know, describe your book in a short paragraph, your, you know, 350-page book in one short paragraph. So The Unlocked Path, which was my debut novel, presents first and foremost a term that began to emerge at the end of the 19th century. It was a term of a new woman for the upcoming new century at the turn of the 20th century. Women who were educated, career-minded, and independent. So in The Unlocked Path, and set in 1897 Philadelphia, I have my fictional character, Eliza Edwards, rejecting those society norms and her mother's wishes that she have a society debut. And instead, in part spurred on by kind of a tragedy in her family with one of her aunts, Eliza decides to enroll in and apply to Women's Medical College. And this is at a time in 1897 when less than 5% of all of our doctors were women. And then she is supported by a circle of women. And together, they are driven by a determination to conquer curriculum demands, battle sexism, and overcome their own doubts. She really is charting a new life course in a coming-of-age story. So that's the first book, The Unlocked Path. The Path Beneath Her Feet is a sequel that picks up Dr. Edwards' story now in 1936. So the first book goes 1897 to 1920, takes her through medical school, through her residency and early practice. And then I jump to the height of the Depression, 1936, and Eliza is now a mature mentor. but she's still steadfast in her calling to affect social change by addressing women's health issues and guiding others to realize their dreams. Now, as the Depression ravages careers across the board, you know, unemployment at over 30%, Eliza has to redefine her abilities. And she ends up traveling on new paths to Georgia and Tennessee, reclaiming her purpose and rediscovering her ambition, in part through the American Women's Hospital's rural units in Appalachia. The story then moves into the 1940s, World War II, and life on the home front, while Dr. Eliza Edwards still is following her unyielding pursuit to limit suffering and save lives. So that's the brief version. You'll have to pick up both books to read the full version.
Yeah, and I feel like, I mean, just hearing about the first book, if you read it, I would have to read the second book.
It's a must. Everyone said, I meet with a lot of book clubs, and they all, after the first reading the first book, they're like, well, what happens next? And I'm like, well, read the sequel.
Yeah, I mean, I have a growing book list for this next year. So those are two more books to add to my book list. It sounds so interesting. And I was saying before, and I don't mean to be repetitive, but I think it's just also so inspiring that it's what draws me most to wanting to read them. So your books are so rich in historical detail. How did you go about that research behind your work? Were there stories or moments that surprised you along the way?
Oh, yeah, a lot of research. First, reading a lot of nonfiction. So things like an invaluable book in my research was actually the history of the Women's Medical College, A New and Untried Course by Dr. Stephen Peitzman. I read a couple of books, about Elizabeth Blackwell, Early Doctors. And I was trying to just scan my bookcase, Sympathy and Science, which was actually a theme and almost a model of women's medical, the practice of sympathy and science for women doctors particularly. So a lot of nonfiction books. And then I did interviews. I interviewed current medical students who were women, thinking that, you know, their struggles probably weren't all that different today than it was over 100 years ago, some medical advisors. But the biggest resource and really the place that I could have spent days and days and days there, Drexel University's Legacy Center. So Women's Medical College was the first women's medical school opened in 1850 and the longest running school all the way until the early 1970s, when they did accept a few men, changed their name then to Medical College of Pennsylvania, but then eventually merged with Drexel. Mm-hmm. So Drexel in Philadelphia has all of the archival materials from women's medical. And I was able to spend two full days there, one day for each book, pouring through, oh my gosh, so many incredible artifacts, correspondence, grade reports, financial records, dean's reports, photographs, items like a bone box. Now, that was something that kind of surprised me that I had to include in the book, was that students had to rent a bone box and they had to put down a $5 deposit. That was a lot of money in 1897. But they got about 15 to 20 bones. And between the 40 students in the class, they could assemble two full skeletons. At the end of the year, inventory their box. If all the contents were there, they got 80% of their $5 back. So that was pretty cool. And I definitely, you know, bring that into a fun scene in the first book while Eliza's at medical school. Now, another moment that blew me away when I'm in the archives. And Matt Herbison is the primary archivist there, had pulled together for my second book, I said, anything related to the 1930s and 40s. Mm-hmm. So he had like two carts filled with different folders of information. And so I'm going through them chronologically, and I'm now into the 1940s, and I open a folder file, and there's a small pamphlet that pretty official looking. And I look at it much more closely, and I'm like, what is this? And it looked like, you know, a bunch of official language. Well, it was the congressional hearings transcript in the U.S. Congress in 1942.
Wow.
When the War Department had shortly, either right before or right after Pearl Harbor in 1941, okay, the War Department had written a law that said the War Department had the legal rights to draft medical personnel for the war effort. Okay. So they could draft persons for that were medical professionals for the war effort. I'm like, okay, well, what is going on here? Well, when war broke out and the U.S. is involved and they're calling up everyone, of course, women doctors want to serve.
Right.
They had volunteered in World War I. And had never been accepted. And that actually was the formation of the American Women's Hospital Unit. It's a self-funded group that went to France without any connection to the U.S. Army Medical Corps. By World War II, these women doctors, the next generation, most of them, said, we want to serve. But listen, this time, we're going to serve with full rank, military pay, and veterans benefits, because you're saying you're going to draft medical professionals. Yes, but the War Department says, we didn't mean women. So when we said people or persons, we didn't mean women. So women weren't people? What? I had to put that in my book. So this congressional hearings pamphlet that I found was 3 days that our fine U.S. Congress debated whether women were people or not.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So they got it overturned, and over 8,000 women doctors joined the U.S. Army Medical Corps, received their benefits, received their rank, and in fact, the first to receive commission was the dean, current dean of women's medical, Margaret Craighill, who became Major Margaret Craighill.
Wow, that's so cool. I can't believe it. They were like, oh, women are not people. When we thought people, we didn't think of women. Like, what is this?
Yeah, and that wasn't all that long ago, 80 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, that's not that long ago. You're right. Yeah, that's just shocking. Once you started learning about the women who attended the Women's Medical College, how did you decide which aspects of their experience to weave into your characters and plot?
Yeah, so my main character, because I didn't really want to write a biographical historical fiction, I wanted to bring to life lots of women medical professionals. So Eliza Edwards is a fictional character, but she's considered a composite character. Mm-hmm. So she's inspired by a lot of my research, different pieces and different elements of many different women that I read about. There were two women in The Unlocked Path that are based on real women. Dr. Charlotte Fairbanks was also a graduate of Women's Medical in 1902, I believe she was. And she was a surgeon. She was the chief surgeon that went to France with the American Women's Hospital Unit. So, you know, I had to, you know, think of, well, a surgeon is going to be someone that's, you know, very precise, you know, very straight and narrow, you know, getting down to business. So that really shaped Charlotte's character and the way she interacted with people. Mm-hmm. The other woman that I included was Dr. Olga Pavinsky. So she came from Lithuania, was not speaking a word of English, 18 years old when she entered Women's Medical in 1897. She went on to be very, very highly accomplished as well. But there was one little snippet that I read about her that quoted her, somebody interviewing her after she had gone to an anatomy class, and the topic of the day was talking about Darwinism. And she's, you know, Lithuania, still learning the language. And, yeah. You know, they asked them, well, what did you think about the lecture? And she's like, I'm not really sure. I followed all of it. I thought it was a bunch of monkey business. Olga's got a great sharp wit. Now, whether she even knew it or not, that she was, you know, making a play on words there, monkey business. I think she probably knew she was doing it. That helped me shape her character to have some fun. In the path beneath her feet, I continue with both Olga and Charlotte coming back as friends and supporters of Eliza and her circle. But I take a much more direct route with Olga's path, that she went on to be employed with the New York Department of Public Health for 40 years, working in bacteriology, working on toxins and vaccines for diphtheria, and, you know, all of these incredible diseases that claimed so, so many lives before we had vaccines for them. And she even designed a culture bottle that I still don't understand the scientific mechanics of it, but the design of the bottle was such, it was a rectangular bottle, and it was quite large, that it became instrumental in using that specific bottle for Jonas Salk's development of the polio vaccine.
Wow.
And there's actually now a life science company in New Hampshire that manufactures the Olga Pavinsky bottle. It's trademarked. So they were pretty cool. And then the work of Dr. Esther Pohl Lovejoy, Dr. Lillian South, Dr. Hilla Sheriff, all of those were amazing women that started the American Women's Hospital Unit in the rural South in Appalachia in the 1930s, opening maternity centers and driving mobile health units through those mountain mud-filled roads. So that all comes to life in the path beneath her feet.
Wow, that is some really impressive work that they did and that you found out about and that you write about. Yeah. So you talk about how Eliza is a composite character, right?
Right.
How did you go about developing her as a character? Were there specific qualities or real life figures that influenced how you shaped her story?
Yeah, so again, a lot of the material from the archives, reading correspondence of students writing to the dean, writing like their application essays, kind of shaped Eliza. My interviews with med students, and one of the questions that I asked them was, why did you decide you wanted to go to medical school?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if I would call it a majority, but enough made the same similar type of statement that they were personally affected by a family member with either a chronic disease or you know, died from the complications of a terrible disease or injury of some sort. And so that's why I pulled in Eliza's decision, that she's impacted by the loss of her aunt in the opening scene of the book, that makes her reevaluate her life. And then there's also on Instagram showing that this older writer here is still hip enough that she's on Instagram. But there's an Instagram account called Women in Medicine. I don't know if anybody follows it, but it's fabulous in that they are, it's always women posting, and it's a lot of students, I think, you know, their fears, their struggle as they're going through medical school, their self-doubt. And then you see the support that comes in from everybody else posting and replying and saying, I've been there. It happened to me. Keep going. You got this. So that sisterhood feeling and circle of women was really important to make sure that Eliza had that same type of support too, and that she would look to it and lean on it, knowing it would be there.
Wow. Yeah, I think, honestly, even it's been years since when Eliza's stories take place to now, it's kind of unfortunate that many women medical students still face some of the same issues, and
yes,
the support that we give to each other can really just help us make it through.
Absolutely.
I read that you consulted beta and sensitivity readers, including Dr. Eliza Chin, executive director of AMWA, and Dr. Molly Marr, currently in residency at Massachusetts General, as part of your manuscript development. So what role did their feedback play in shaping the accuracy and authenticity of your portrayal of women in medicine?
So I finished writing my manuscript, and I'm pretty pleased with it. I've worked with, you know, a couple of editors. I've gotten feedback from some other what's called beta readers, other friends that I've developed along the way in writing circles. Trusted that they would give me critical feedback. And then I get to a point where I'm realizing, and there's kind of a lot going on more globally in the publishing industry, of thinking about writers being authentic to their story, especially if they're writing a character or a story that they don't personally identify with or haven't personally experienced. How can you really be authentic to those stories? So that was really actually a new kind of issue that was popping up in 2020, when I'm getting ready now to get my book published. And so I kind of stopped and I thought, I have no background in medicine. Full disclosure. I don't even know how I passed Bio 101, a required class at my liberal arts school. So I had a friend in my writing group. He was writing a memoir of his work in a New York City ER department. So he did look at a couple of my medical scenes and made sure I was accurate there. But then I kept thinking, you know, that's great. And thank you, Ted, for that. But I really need a woman doctor to read this,
right,
to make sure that I am being authentic to a woman's experience in these situations. So I am forever grateful to Dr. Chin for answering a blind email I sent to info@amwa.org, just looking for someone to help me. I even proposed maybe there's a retired doctor in your membership that might want to be interested in this little project. And Dr. Chin, you know, replied and said she was interested. She did say it. I'm not going to lie, it helped that your main character's first name is Eliza. So I sent it off to her, and she came back with some amazing feedback, you know, even corrected a couple, and Molly, Dr. Molly Marr, also helped correct a couple of other medical scenes, kind of more in the OBGYN area that I don't think my ER doctor friend knew as much about. and then also pulled out for me a couple of instances of being authentic to the time period, which is the early 20th century, but also being cognizant of today's readers and social justice movements that were going on. Specifically called out a scene where I mentioned that a baby is born as a mongoloid. Now, that was the term used all the way up until the 1960s when we started to accept the use of Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. But mongoloid and mongoloism certainly can be an offensive term to today's readers. So I had to kind of work with how do I be authentic to the time period, but not be offensive. So we kind of reworked those scenes where I infer from a description of the baby that he was a mongoloid or he had Down syndrome. But I don't have my character, Dr. Edwards, say the word.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I kept it in later in the book when it was truly being used as a medical reference, but it wasn't being spoken from the point of view of my character. Another instance was where I have a scene where Dr. Edwards is distributing copies of Family Limitations, the pamphlet directed on birth control created by Margaret Sanger. Again, needed to be authentic to the time period, but Margaret Sanger, unfortunately,'s name later on became associated with the eugenics movement. So had to tiptoe around that issue as well. But if, you know, Dr. Chin hadn't pointed out both of those instances to me and helped me recast the scenes so that they would be authentic. And then finally, just as a fun note, I even passed my cover design by Dr. Chin, and I had staged the photo on the front cover, which has a kind of vintage looking, you know, black doctor's bag, and there's a stethoscope draped over it. Well, I had bought both of these off of eBay, you know, trying to find vintage pieces. Well, the original stethoscope I had black tubing.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Chin pointed out that at that time period, it would have been a brown rubber tubing. So thank you, Photoshop. We were able to get authentic the time period there, too.
That is so nice that Dr. Elisa responded to your email.
Absolutely.
What do you hope readers take away from your work, not just about the characters, but about the time period or about women's roles more broadly?
Yes, so I think it goes back to what inspired me to write this book, in that we really need to appreciate and celebrate what the women of past generations went through to unlock and pave the path available for women in medicine today. I mean, when you think that they were denied admission to medical schools, once they graduated with an accredited degree in their hands, they still couldn't find jobs because so many hospitals wouldn't hire them or they had very limited slots reserved for women. In fact, Women's Medical College opened the first hospital associated with a higher learning institution. And that was mainly to give their graduates a place to go to work. And then thinking that, you know, over 125 years ago, you know, only about 5% of our women doctors were women. And that actually dropped to 4% during the Depression. When many women had to close their practices or lost their jobs or, you know, men's telling their wives they weren't going to pay the fee for them to go see a woman doctor, go see a man doctor. He's the head of a household. He needs a job. You know, that was the primary battle cry during the Depression. And yet now, I just saw for Amois, 38%. of doctors are women. And a group, Learn at Pinnacle, mentioned that 54% of medical students now are women. How awesome is that? So, you know, yes, there are still disparities in pay between the genders or the presence in different specialties, but that 54% of medical students today that are sitting there identifying as women, they need to appreciate and understand what the women that came before them went through.
I agree. I think we have so much to thank them for because they opened the door for the many women that followed them and for us as well today. And yeah, like you said, my matriculating class, there were more women in my class than there were.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So we've made a lot of progress, but there's still more progress to do.
Absolutely.
And like you said, it's important to recognize everything that has done in the past for mm-hmm. us to get to where we are today.
Yes.
In what ways do you hope your stories move the conversation forward on gender equity in medicine or even beyond the world of medicine?
Yeah, again, it's showcasing their accomplishments that were just as important and contributed to the advancement of medicine and patient care as those achieved by men. That women have the same skills, have gone through the same training, have the same fortitude and ability to study and practice medicine, and perhaps even a little bit more so that they also apply a sense of sympathy and empathy to their patients. And I know Amwa has done studies on this too, just about, you know, listening to patients. And there is a differential between the genders. Actually, I meet with a lot of book clubs. And one question that I like to pose to them is whether they specifically seek out a woman doctor. You know, most of my book club members are women. And the vast majority answered yes. When they think about that sympathy and empathy equation, especially for OBGYN. And then for specialized care, though, most would say they just want the best qualified, whether that's a man or a woman. They just, you know, want the best out there that they can find in their area. So to kind of illustrate this idea about, you know, how far we've come and the gender question and the abilities of women then and now, I'd like to read a fairly short excerpt from The Unlocked Path. And this is takes place in around 1904, 1905. So my main character, Eliza Edwards, is in her residency at the West Philadelphia Hospital. And hopefully this excerpt reflects what many residents feel, but with a slight twist of the time setting. As the room settled into quiet anticipation, the door opened again to admit another staff member, the newest addition and the most senior. Dr. Whitaker walked to the center of the theater where Dr. Howe awaited him. Beads of deep-set dark brown eyes considered the personnel assembled before him. A thick mustache spread across his upper lip like a trimmed hedge, creeping to the far reaches of his cheeks. His starched high-collared shirt stood as stiff as the clipboard in his hands. His black suit and silk tie resembled an undertaker's. The new administrator stepped in front of Dr. Howe. Douglas Whitaker would make his own introduction. Good morning. For those who didn't read Dr. Howe's communication last week, I am Dr. Whitaker, administrator of West Philadelphia Hospital. I've spent the past 8 years at the esteemed Grady Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, one of my city's newest hospitals. We've been rebuilding ever since your General Sherman marched through with torches in his hand and Southern blood on his sleeve. As Dr. Whitaker continued to espouse his credentials and hint at other vestiges of hostilities from the war between the states, Eliza's eyelids grew heavy. Her shift had started at 7 with a routine delivery, followed by the adrenaline-rushed emergency of Bianca versus the balloon. Now, with time to relax, fatigue enveloped her body. Her shoulders slumped as her head bobbed. When her chin hit her chest, she shook from the siren of sleep. Much to learn. I expect intake forms to be concise and complete. You'll follow orders without questions and treatments administered according to directives of your supervisors. Eliza caught these comments, thinking they were useless. Every staff member followed orders and administered care under their supervisor's direction. Her patient forms and reports were always complete. She allowed her eyes to droop again. I am adjusting doctors' schedules and assignments. Grady Hospital is similar in size to West Philadelphia, but I find the number of physicians here limiting. While I work to secure funding to hire more graduates from Jefferson Medical School or Pennsylvania, I will schedule separate female doctors or residents from the same shift. I've heard how too much time together can stimulate an alignment of womanly cycles. I won't have an entire shift of practicing doctors and nurses incapacitated on the same days each month. So that was quite often the attitudes of many of women in the workplace, especially, you know, when they are performing what can often be physical labor that many doctors would have to do. And it plays off of and comes from the research that I had done into work by Mary Putnam Jacoby, who was graduated from Women's Medical in 1864, and in 1876 was the first woman to receive the Boylston Medical Prize from Harvard University for her essay on the question of rest for women during menstruation. So her entire study pretty much went on to debunk information that had previously come out from a Dr. Edward Clark's publication of Sex in Education, or Fair Chance for the Girls, which had questioned the expanded role of women in society and in professions. So Dr. Jacoby kind of goes on to prove out that women are stable, they're strong, they're agile, they're not rattled during their menstrual cycles. So that scene from The Unlocked Path is paying homage to Dr. Jacoby's work and prize-winning work.
Wow. If I had been there sitting, listening to that address, I would be so infuriated listening.
Yeah, well, you read the rest of the scene, you find out Eliza, too, is infuriated and even says, I'm going to go throw some of Dr. Jacoby's research onto his desk tomorrow morning.
Yeah, I will do the same thing. Oh, my gosh. I don't even have the words. It's just jaw-dropping to hear something like that. So before we close, that was all the questions that I had prepared, but before we end, I just wanted to ask you if there's anything else that you would like to share with the audience.
Well, just first, I would like to thank you, Laura, for having me on the podcast and discussing such an important topic. You know, the title is, you know, partly, you know, looking to the future, but let's not forget the past as well. I always hope through historical fiction in particular that reaches a broader audience that hopefully we will learn from our past and improve for our future. And of course, if anyone is interested in reading my books, they are available on Amazon, paperback, ebook, Audible version, Barnes & Noble. You can ask any local bookstore or library to order your copy. I also have paperback copies available for purchase directly from me. And anyone that does make a purchase directly from me and mentions moi or mentions they heard about my books from the podcast, I am happy to make a $5 donation for each purchase to the American Women's Hospital Unit, who continues to do great work still around the world and funding many different clinics and practices and travel stipends for students even. So I would be happy to make that donation in the name of whoever purchases the book. All you have to do is drop me an email, and it's Janis, J-A-N-I-S, at janisrdaly.com. Or check out my website, contact me through my website, which is also just janisrdaly.com.
Well, thank you so much, Janis. I really enjoyed our conversation. It was also very nice to meet you and to learn more about everything that went behind writing your two works. And that's a wrap on this episode of Our Voices, Our Future. We hope today's conversation inspired you, challenged you, and reminded you of the power of raising your voice. The fight for equity doesn't stop here. Join us in the movement. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you loved this episode, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Until next time, stay bold, stay vocal, and keep the conversation going. This is Our Voices, Our Future.